Hello, this is Elizabeth Ortel, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the November 5th, Wednesday, New York Times. Mamdani is elected mayor, capping ascent. First Muslim to lead the city, a triumph for progressives by Emma Fitzsimmons. Zohran Mamdani, a once unheralded state lawmaker from Queens, whose affordability platform and charisma fueled a meteoric political rise, was elected on Tuesday as the 111th mayor of New York, according to the Associated Press. The victory by Mr. Mamdani, 34, a Democratic socialist, placed a final stamp on the astonishing ascent of an assemblyman who rose from anonymity to defeat better-known rivals like former Governor Andrew Cuomo, first in the Democratic primary, and now again in the general election. His win represents a major triumph for progressives, empowering a new coalition of younger voters and immigrants who volunteered for his campaign, filled its coffers with thousands of small donations, and flocked to the polls to elect the city's first Muslim mayor. When Mr. Mamdani takes office on January 1st, he will become the highest-ranking Muslim elected official in the United States, a breakthrough for many Muslim Americans who feel pride in his success and anxiety over Islamophobia. His campaign has stirred, nearly a quarter century after the September 11th attacks. Mr. Mamdani, who was born in Uganda to parents of Indian descent and moved to this New York City as a boy, will also be the first South Asian mayor, the city's youngest mayor in more than a century, its second democratic socialist mayor, and first millennial mayor. He could face significant challenges bringing the city together after a bitter campaign. He must navigate hostility from President Trump, who has reportedly attacked him as he works to deliver on his ambitious, affordability-minded campaign promises. Mr. Mamdani ran on simple pledges to make buses free, to freeze the rent on rent-stabilized apartments, and to provide universal free child care. The results in New York came as Democrats across the country sought to make gains to combat Mr. Trump's agenda. In the Virginia governor's race, Abigail Spanberger, a moderate Democrat who served three terms in Congress, defeated Lieutenant Governor Winsom Earl Sears, a socially conservative Republican. In the New Jersey governor's race, Representative Mickey Schirrell, a Democrat, prevailed over Jack Ciattarelli, a Republican. And in California, voters were considering a ballot measure that would allow the redrawing of congressional districts to create more Democratic seats and help offset Republican-led redistricting efforts in Texas and elsewhere. In New York, Mr. Mamdani defeated Mr. Cuomo, 67, who ran as an independent after losing the Democratic primary, and Curtis Sliwa, the Republican best known as the founder of the Guardian Angels anti-crime organization. For months, Mr. Cuomo mercilessly attacked Mr. Mamdani as too inexperienced and too far to the left. From the front page of the New York Times, election updates. California approves redistricting plan as Democrats rack up key wins. Voters backed redrawing California's congressional districts, countering Republican efforts in red states. Democrats won high-profile governor's races in New Jersey and Virginia and notched other victories across the nation. Democrats seized the momentum they were seeking as they head into 2026. They claimed a series of victories in off-year elections on Tuesday night, turning contests across the country and up and down the ballot into an enthusiastic display of opposition to President Trump that they hope will turbocharge their march to towards next year's midterms. In California, voters blessed a mid-cycle redistricting effort intended to partially neutralize a push by Mr. Trump to draw up more safe Republican House seats before next year's election. And two Democratic women in closely watched governor's races, Representative Mickey Schirrell of New Jersey and former Representative Abigail Spanberger of Virginia, handily beat Republicans who aligned themselves with the president. California voters waited in long lines to cast ballots even after the outcome was clear. Voters across Southern California waited in long lines to vote on Tuesday evening, in some cases after the outcome of the only question on the ballot had already been called. Their eagerness to vote on the ballot measure, which would temporarily redraw the state's congressional districts to favor Democrats, showed more successfully leaders in Democratic-leaning California had framed a yes vote as a rebuke of President Trump. "We saw a line literally around the block," said Eli Lippman, the director of a transit and infrastructure nonprofit in Los Angeles. "We couldn't believe it." Mr. Lippman estimated that there were about 200 people waiting to vote when he and his wife arrived at their neighborhood elementary school at about 7:35 p.m., about half an hour before polls were to close. As soon as they did, at 8 p.m., the Associated Press declared that the measure had passed by a wide margin. In California, vote centers have to stay open for anyone who is in line by 8 p.m. Reports by officials and images on social media showed queues snaking around polling sites. Governor Gavin Newsom, the measure's biggest champion, framed it as an emergency response to redistricting in Texas to favor Republicans. On social media, he reposted video of hundreds of college students sitting on retaining walls or shuffling, phones in hand, as they waited to vote at the University of California, San Diego. He also shared an image of a line looping around a polling place in a predominantly Latino community in Los Angeles County that has been hit particularly hard by immigration raids. John Erickson, a city council member in West Hollywood, posted a video showing a line that snaked around Plumer Park, where there was a polling site at about 6 p.m. "People are very excited to vote," he wrote. Polling places were busy throughout the day on Tuesday as in-person voters added to the millions of already early votes and mail-in ballots. Although election officials won't have full numbers on Tuesday night, the long lines to vote in person in a special election with one statewide issue on the ballot suggests that turnout could be robust. Heading into Election Day, more than 7.2 million Californians had already voted, about a third of registered voters. Mike Sanchez, spokesman for the Los Angeles County Registrar Recorder, said that long lines were typical on Election Day evenings, but in-person turnout was on track to meet or slightly exceed that of 2021, when Republicans tried to recall Governor Gavin Newsom. In Los Angeles County, turnout that year was close to 52%. From page A1, Dick Cheney, powerful vice president and Washington insider, dies at 84. A former defense secretary and congressman, he held the nation's number two job under President George W. Bush and was an architect of policies in an era of war and economic change. By Robert D. McFadden. Dick Cheney, widely regarded as the most powerful vice president in American history, who was George W. Bush's running mate in two successful campaigns for the presidency, and his most influential White House advisor in an era of terrorism, war, and economic change, died on Monday. He was 84. The cause was complications of pneumonia and cardiac and vascular disease, according to a statement by his family who said he died in Northern Virginia. Mr. Cheney had homes in McLean, Virginia, and Jackson, Wyoming. Plagued by coronary problems nearly all his adult life, Mr. Cheney had 5 heart attacks from 1978 to 2010 and had worn a device to regulate his heartbeat since 2001. But his health issues did not seem to impair his performance as vice president. In 2012, 3 years after retiring, he underwent a successful heart transplant and had been reasonably active since then. Most recently, he startled Americans of both parties by announcing that he would vote for Vice President Kamala Harris, a Democrat, in the 2024 election, denouncing her Republican opponent, former President Donald J. Trump, as unfit for the Oval Office and a grave threat to American democracy. "We have a duty to put country above partisanship to defend our Constitution," Mr. Cheney said. His announcement echoed that of an earlier one by his daughter, Liz Cheney, the former Republican representative from Wyoming, who broke with Mr. Trump after the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol by his followers. She, too, said she would vote for Ms. Harris. As vice presidents go, Mr. Cheney was a singular figure, more powerful and less ambitious for higher office than any vice president in modern times. A 10-year member of the House of Representatives, the youngest White House chief of staff in history, the defense secretary from 1989 to 1993, a confidant of presidents and lawmakers, Mr. Cheney had impeccable credentials and contacts and was a master in the art of getting things done, preferably without fanfare. In many ways, an inscrutable personality, he had no patience for small talk, almost never spoke about himself, and rarely gave interviews or held news conferences, although he sometimes went on television to promote administration policies and was often in the news. He preferred the backstage to the spotlight. A consummate Washington insider, Mr. Cheney was an architect and executor of President Bush's major initiatives, deploying military power to advance, they said, the cause of democracy abroad, championing free markets and deregulation at home, and strengthening the powers of a presidency that, as both men saw it, had been unjustifiably restrained by Congress and the courts in the aftermath of the Vietnam War and the Watergate scandal. As Mr. Bush's most trusted and valued counselor, Mr. Cheney foraged at will over fields of international and domestic policy. Like a super cabinet official with an unlimited portfolio, he used his authority to make the case for war, propose or kill legislation, recommend Supreme Court candidates, tip the balance for a tax cut, promote the interests of allies and parry opponents. But it was the national security arena where he had the most profound impact. As Defense Secretary, he helped engineer the Persian Gulf War that successfully evicted Iraqi invaders from Kuwait in 1991, and then took a leading role a decade later in responding to the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. To prevent future attacks, he advocated aggressive policies, including warrantless surveillance, indefinite detention, and brutal interrogation tactics, and he pushed for the invasion of Iraq to topple Saddam Hussein in 2003, completing the unfinished job of his previous stint in power by leading to years of warfare. You're listening to a reading of articles from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Early in Mr. Bush's first term, many Democrats and even some fellow Republicans wondered if Mr. Cheney might be the real power in a White House occupied by an untested president whose qualifications had been questioned. While Mr. Bush eventually asserted his authority and Mr. Cheney's influence declined by the second term, the image of him as a Machiavellian paterfamilias was never quite dispelled. Even Mr. Bush worried about that perception, as he noted in his 2010 memoir, Decision Points. He wrote that Mr. Cheney offered to withdraw from the ticket for the 2004 presidential election, having become the Darth Vader of the administration. Mr. Bush considered the offer, aware that accepting it would be one way to demonstrate that I was in charge. But he ultimately kept his running mate, saying he valued the vice president's steadiness and friendship. There was no question about Mr. Cheney's steadiness. On September 11th, 2001, when hijacked airliners destroyed the World Trade Center in New York and crashed into the Pentagon and into a Pennsylvania field, killing nearly 3,000 people in the nation's worst terrorist attack, it was Mr. Cheney who took charge at the White House. Mr. Bush, who was visiting a school in Florida as the attacks took place, was shuttled to secure locations in Louisiana and Nebraska. The vice president activated defense measures across the nation, put American forces on alert around the world, and ordered the Capitol evacuated and government leaders removed to safety. From a White House bunker, he maintained continuous contact with the president and other officials and kept what many called a steady hand at the helm through the crisis. In the aftermath, Mr. Cheney became the strategist behind a rapid expansion of presidential power to fight terrorism and a forceful proponent of Mr. Bush's doctrinal warning to the world that nations and regimes would be counted as for or against the United States in the new age of terrorism, and that preemptive military action would be taken against anyone who posed a threat to the security of the country. 6 weeks after the attacks, Mr. Cheney helped engineer a swift, lopsided passage of the USA Patriot Act, a sweeping law that greatly expanded the government's powers of investigation, surveillance, and detention to fight terrorism. With the wounded nation still seething over September 11th, public opposition to the law was muted, though civil libertarians warned that it authorized the government to spy on ordinary Americans. Later, it became clear that the act was being used to underpin secret courts, wiretaps without warnings, the unlimited detention of suspects without hearings or charges, and interrogation methods that skirted bans on torture in the Geneva Conventions. There were wide protests and even constitutional challenges. But Mr. Cheney strongly defended the law and its expansion of presidential power, and it remained in force. Mr. Cheney also strongly influenced Mr. Bush's decision to invade Afghanistan to hunt for Osama bin Laden, the Qaeda leader who masterminded the September 11th attacks, and to suppress a fanatical Taliban regime that had sheltered terrorists and imposed a brutal theocracy on the Afghan people. And it was Mr. Cheney who was a dominant voice behind Mr. Bush's decision to invade Iraq in 2003, and then to justify the war. He insisted that Iraq's President Saddam Hussein had ties to Qaeda terrorists, possess weapons of mass destruction, and would threaten America and its allies with nuclear blackmail. What began as a one-month combat operation in Iraq gave way to a nearly nine-year occupation, a struggle against Iraqi insurgents, an internecine warfare that would claim the lives of nearly 4,500 American military personnel, and it is believed at least 100,000 Iraqis. Estimates vary. Cost more than $2 trillion, according to some reports, and leave a staggering trail of destruction throughout the country. As the war dragged on, the outlines of an enormous intelligence failure began to emerge. The September 11th Commission, an independent panel given the task of investigating the 2001 attacks, found no evidence of collaboration between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. And the chief weapons inspector of the Central Intelligence Agency, a White House appointee, concluded that Iraq had no stockpiles of biological, chemical, or nuclear weapons. But these findings were released as Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney campaigned for re-election in 2004, and the candidates conceded nothing. To delay, defer, wait wasn't an option, Mr. Cheney said. The president did exactly the right thing. The Democratic candidate, Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts, and his running mate, Senator John Edwards of North Carolina, tried to press the matter. But the debate over whether America had been led into war under false pretenses appeared to lose coherence as a grinding election year issue. It came into focus again in Mr. Bush's second term. However, as American patience with the war started to wear thin amid a rising toll of American and Iraqi deaths, soaring costs in the face of an economic downturn at home, persistent questions about the humiliation and torture of enemy detainees, and the administration's lack of a clear timetable and exit strategy. By the midterm elections in 2006, with the war into its fourth year and no end in sight, public frustration had reached a tipping point. Democrats, energized after years of passivity, promised changes. Riding a wave of voter dissatisfaction, they swept to majorities in both houses of Congress for the first time since 1994. After the election, Mr. Bush dismissed Defense Secretary Donald H. Rumsfeld, Mr. Cheney's closest administration ally, and a lightning rod for war critics, and named Robert M. Gates, a former director of Central Intelligence, as his successor. The president also spoke of cooperating with Congress and said he would consider proposals from a bipartisan Iraq study group calling for gradual disengagement from Iraq. But it soon became clear that Mr. Bush intended to do neither. In early 2007, with Mr. Cheney's endorsement, the president sent tens of thousands of American troops to Iraq, augmenting the 132,000 there in a surge to help the government quell violence around Baghdad. The House passed a non-binding resolution against the plan, to which Mr. Cheney declared, "It won't stop us." It seemed nothing would. After years of carnage and sectarian violence that had led Iraq on the brink of civil war, Mr. Cheney dismissed suggestions that the country was on the verge of collapse. "The reality on the ground is that we've made major progress," he said. He argued that pulling out before Iraq was able to defend itself would set off a bloodbath between Sunni and Shiite sects. By the spring of 2008, as the war entered its sixth year, and American deaths surpassed 4,000, it was apparent that the conflict would be inherited by the next president. Mr. Cheney said that the war had lasted longer than I would have anticipated, but that it had been well worth the effort. Defending a legacy. During the 2008 presidential race, the Democratic nominee, Senator Barack Obama of Illinois, castigated the administration over the Iraq War. The Republican nominee, Senator John McCain of Arizona, who often used the shorthand Al-Qaeda to refer to a protein and increasingly divided enemy, warned against a premature troop withdrawal from Iraq, but rarely mentioned Mr. Bush or Mr. Cheney, distancing himself from a team whose day was nearly over. After an almost two-year campaign, Mr. Obama's election presaged broad changes in foreign and domestic policy. The Iraq War was hardly the only leftover problem. In Afghanistan, a resurgent Taliban posed new dangers. Bin Laden's terrorist network had been rebuilt in tribal strongholds of Pakistan. America's alliances were frayed. Disputes with Iran, North Korea, Russia, and other potential adversaries lingered. And the American and global economics were in deep distress, a result, many experts said, of Republican policies. A month before leaving office, Mr. Cheney struck an unapologetic tone in exit interviews, defending the use of broad executive powers in waging war, in the treatment of terrorism suspects, and in domestic wiretapping, insisting that historians would ultimately look favorably on the administration's efforts to keep the nation safe. On January 20, 2009, Mr. Cheney, who had hurt his back moving boxes and attended the inauguration at the Capitol in a wheelchair, was succeeded by Senator Joseph R. Biden, Jr. of Delaware. The two had been lobbing verbal grenades at each other for months. Mr. Biden had called Mr. Cheney probably the most dangerous vice president we've had in American history, and vowed to restore the balance to the office. Mr. Cheney fired back, "If he wants to diminish the office of vice president, that's obviously his call." As Mr. Obama took over, Mr. Cheney broke with a long-standing practice of becoming inconspicuous after leaving office. He contended that the new president was endangering the country by planning to close the detention camp at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, suspending military trials for terrorism suspects, and prohibiting interrogation techniques like waterboarding. In a blitz of television appearances and speeches, Mr. Cheney soon emerged as the leading Republican critic of the new administration. No one envisioned that he would run again for elective office, but with his tenacity and insider's knowledge of government and politics, he seemed to be mounting more than a rearguard defense of Bush policies. Rather, the aim, it appeared, was to influence the continuing national security debate as well as his own legacy. By then, he had joined a parade of Bush associates working on memoirs. His book, In My Time, A Personal and Political Memoir, 2011, with Liz Cheney, expressed few regrets over the most controversial decisions of the Bush administration. While defending its actions, the book sidestepped many important questions in discussing the debates that had ensued over its policies, some reviewers said. By 2014, 5 years after leaving the White House, Mr. Cheney's command of public attention seemed undiminished. Far from fading into the background of history, he thrust himself into national debates with an onslaught of more broadcasts and published commentaries assailing Mr. Obama's responses to Islamic militants in Iraq and Syria. He also went to Capitol Hill to urge Republicans to reject a rising isolationism in their party and embrace strong military and foreign policies. You were listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times and the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And when the Senate Intelligence Committee accused the CIA of torturing terrorism suspects during the Bush years, Mr. Cheney rose to defend the agency, arguing that its interrogations had been legally authorized and absolutely totally justified. He roundly dismissed allegations that the CIA had misled the White House about its methods or inflated the value of the information obtained from prisoners. Tensions in the White House. Several years before Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney left office, evidence that there had been no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq was overwhelming, and even Mr. Cheney abandoned the claim. But debate over the administration's justification for waging war never went away, with the focus turning to the vice president's office in the fall of 2005, when Mr. Cheney's chief of staff, I. Lewis Libby Jr., was indicted on charges of perjury and obstruction of justice. The charges were filed by a special prosecutor investigating the illegal disclosure of the identity of a covert CIA operative, Valerie Plame Wilson, whose husband, Joseph C. Wilson IV, a former diplomat, had gone to Niger to investigate a report that Iraq had bought weapons-grade uranium there in 1999. Mr. Wilson had found no evidence to support the story and had written an opinion article for the New York Times undermining the administration's rationale for invading Iraq. The significance of the case lay not in the disclosure of an agent's identity, but in what seemed to lay behind it, a plan orchestrated by the White House to discredit Mr. Wilson after his article was published by portraying his trip as a boondoggle that had been set up by his wife. Mr. Libby, who resigned, was not accused of leaking Ms. Wilson's name, but of lying to a grand jury and federal agents when he told them that he had learned her identity from a reporter. The indictment said he had actually learned it from administration officials. It cited Mr. Cheney in three passages, and while it did not accuse him of wrongdoing, strongly suggested that he had been behind the campaign to discredit Mr. Wilson. As Mr. Libby's trial in early 2007, his lawyers argued that he had not lied, but had only misspoken. Neither Mr. Libby nor Mr. Cheney testified. The prosecution witnesses swore that Mr. Libby had learned of Ms. Wilson's identity from officials, and he was found guilty, becoming the highest-ranking White House official convicted of a felony since the Iran-Contra scandals of the 1980s. Mr. Libby was sentenced to 30 months in prison, a $250,000 fine, and 2 years probation. Mr. Bush commuted the prison term, but did not grant a pardon, leaving the fine and probation in place. The president portrayed the commutation as a compromise, but his action reignited passions in the case. Critics called it a subversion of justice to keep Mr. Libby from disclosing White House war planning. Mr. Libby's supporters said his resignation and humiliation had been punishment enough. The case had a corrosive effect on Mr. Cheney's political stature, creating a rift between the president and the vice president, which both acknowledged after leaving office, though the White House initially denied it, saying Mr. Cheney was still Mr. Bush's closest advisor. But even then, some Republican aides acknowledged that the president had been upset and that Mr. Cheney had become less of an avuncular mentor to him. Mr. Bush, in his memoir, said Mr. Cheney had lashed out at him in their final days in office for his refusal to grant Mr. Libby a presidential pardon. "I can't believe you're going to leave a soldier on the battlefield," Mr. Cheney told him heatedly, according to Mr. Bush. The former president wrote, "The comment stung. In 8 years, I had never seen Dick like this, or even close to this." In 2018, President Trump granted a full pardon to Mr. Libby. "I don't know Mr. Libby," Mr. Trump said, "but for years I have heard that he has been treated unfairly." The pardon amounted to a dramatic coda to a case that had once gripped Washington and came to embody divisions over the Iraq War. Mr. Cheney issued a public statement thanking Mr. Trump for the pardon, but it was a rare grace note in an otherwise rocky relationship with the president. Months after the pardon, Mr. Cheney, visiting Mexico, said Mr. Trump had been wrong during his presidential campaign to say that Mexican immigrants were bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists. In another slap at candidate Trump, Mr. Cheney spoke out against his proposal to ban Muslims from entering the United States. "I think this whole notion that somehow we can say no more Muslims, just ban a whole religion, goes against everything we stand for and believe in," Mr. Cheney said. And in 2019, Mr. Cheney, in an off-the-record exchange with Vice President Mike Pence at an American Enterprise Institute forum, complained of Mr. Trump's use of Twitter diplomacy, which was often done without consulting aides or the intelligence community. Mr. Cheney warned that the United States was getting into a situation when our friends and allies around the world that we depend on are going to lack confidence in us. Donald Trump Jr., a close advisor to his father, hit back. "Isn't it fitting," he said, "that Cheney is the one mad that Trump is ending his reckless and endless wars? I never knew peace could be so unpopular." Virginia, over an activist who protested Stephen Miller. Criminal inquiries pit the Miller family's safety concerns against the First Amendment rights of an activist in Northern Virginia critical of the administration by Devlin Barrett. Federal and state criminal investigations into a Virginia woman who distributed leaflets disclosing the home address of White House official Stephen Miller have prompted a secret court fight over the balance between personal safety and free speech at a time of rising political violence, recently unsealed court documents show. The records, which were reviewed by the New York Times, reveal that a local court approved the search of a cell phone belonging to the woman as part of an investigation that included multiple local law enforcement agencies, as well as the FBI and Secret Service. The activist, Barbara Wynn, has not been charged with any crime, though the Virginia State Police still have her phone. The investigation remains active, leaving it unclear whether law enforcement has since gathered additional evidence. The dispute captures the fierce tensions over political activism that have become a defining feature of the second Trump presidency, pitting the Miller family's concerns for their security against the First Amendment claims of a critic of the administration. In an atmosphere in which political violence against Republicans and Democrats has become more common, administration officials have increasingly voiced worries about their security, citing in particular the assassination of the right-wing activist Charlie Kirk and two attempts in 2024 to kill Donald J. Trump. But liberal groups and activists say the White House is seeking to demonize its political opponents and use the levers of government to stamp out opposing views in the name of public safety. At the heart of the clash is whether the involvement of federal authorities in investigating a local act of protest and the tactics used by state and federal investigators amount to overkill, or whether Ms. Nguyen posed a true threat to Mr. Miller and his family. A lawyer for Ms. Nguyen and a county prosecutor have raised concerns over the conduct of the investigation, including the involvement of multiple federal and state agencies. They have also raised questions about the issuance of the search warrant for Ms. Nguyen's phone by state authorities based on evidence that she might have committed a misdemeanor. Ms. Nguyen's lawyer, Bradley R. Haywood, said law enforcement agencies were misusing their authority to pursue a political critic. The county prosecutor, a Democrat, has accused the state attorney general's office, led by a Republican, of overstepping its authority in trying to intervene in the case. A White House spokesperson, Abigail Jackson, said that the law enforcement response was warranted, noting that Mr. Trump and others in his administration have been targets of members of the public. Doxing and any other actions that directly threaten the safety of officials and their families should be resoundingly denounced and thoroughly investigated to ensure attacks against members of the administration are not realized, she said. Court documents cite the Secret Service and FBI as participants in the investigation, asked for comment, and FBI spokesman said that the Bureau had acted appropriately and that the allegations against Ms. Nguyen that were under investigation went well beyond First Amendment protected activity. A spokesman for the Secret Service said he was aware of the case and declined to comment further. One federal statute makes it a crime to make public information like a home address of a government official, but only if the intent behind the disclosure is to threaten, intimidate, or incite the commission or a crime of violence, or with knowledge that the information will be used to do so. Virginia's state law makes it a misdemeanor to publish a person's name or photograph along with their home address with the intent to coerce, intimidate, or harass another person. The investigation centers on Ms. Nguyen, 65, a retired academic, who, along with others, has protested outside the home in Northern Arlington where Mr. Miller lived with his family at the time. The police say she has circulated leaflets in the neighborhood denouncing Mr. Miller and his hard-line policies, including on immigration. One of those leaflets featured Mr. Miller's photograph and address. To a state investigator assigned to the case, such identifying information amounted to the kind of harassment that could violate state law. The Millers recently moved into military housing in Fort McNair in Washington after the protest group in September scrawled messages critical of the Trump administration in chalk on the sidewalk outside their six-bedroom home. One of the messages read, "Stephen Miller is destroying democracy." The state police, accompanied by the FBI and Secret Service, arrived at Ms. Nguyen's door on October 1st with a search warrant for her cell phone, according to court filings. A day later, a lawyer for Ms. Nguyen began fighting the warrant, arguing that it was overly broad and unjustified, violating her rights. In 22 years, I have never seen a situation like this, Mr. Haywood said in an interview. The investigation, he said, raises concerns about whether our state police is carrying water for an administration that is suppressing free speech. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. A spokesman for the Virginia State Police declined to comment because the investigation remained open. The Virginia State Police became involved after a request from Governor Glenn Youngkin, a Republican, according to Richard Cullen, who serves as a counselor to Mr. Youngkin. The governor asked his Secretary of Public Safety to look into it and make sure the family was getting the level of protection they deserve, Mr. Cullen said. That's being prudent in today's world. Mr. Youngkin had issued similar instructions in the past about Supreme Court justices and Antony J. Blinken, then the Secretary of State, after threats and protests erupted near their homes. Mr. Miller, one of the most powerful figures in the federal government, is a driving force behind the Trump administration's decision-making on immigration and law enforcement. Security concerns among Republicans and other public officials ramped up after Mr. Kirk's killing at a public event in Utah, after which Mr. Miller vowed to punish liberal activists and networks that he has cast as terrorists. The organized doxing campaigns, the organized riots, the organized street violence, the organized campaigns of dehumanization, vilification, posting people's addresses, combining that with messaging that's designed to trigger, incite violence in the actual organized cells that carry out and facilitate the violence. It is a vast domestic terror movement, Mr. Miller said on Mr. Kirk's podcast shortly after his death. With God as my witness, he continued, we are going to use every resource we have at the Department of Justice, Homeland Security, and throughout this government to identify, disrupt, dismantle, and destroy these networks and make America safe again for the American people. Mr. Haywood said that Ms. Nguyen and her fellow Arlington activists were only engaged in peaceful advocacy and not seeking to coerce, intimidate, or harass Mr. Miller. They were speaking truth to power, and that is really at the core of our Constitution, he said. It's a principle and a right that our country was founded on. With much of the legal battle played out in sealed court filings, originally at the request of Mr. Haywood, he reversed course in mid-October, noting that the dispute over leaflets and chalk messages had been the subject of local news coverage. All that remains confidential is the fact that law enforcement may be conducting an unconstitutional investigation into those who participated in those advocacy efforts, Mr. Haywood wrote. According to the affidavit used to obtain a search warrant for Ms. Nguyen's cell phone, the case began in August when Mr. Miller's wife, Katie Miller, complained to the police about a leaflet that had been posted in her neighborhood. She informed responding officers that similar flyers had been observed in multiple parks throughout the neighborhood, the affidavit said. The flyer declared Mr. Miller was wanted for crimes against humanity and included his home address, according to a photograph of the leaflet included in the affidavit. No Nazis in NOVA, it said, using an acronym for Northern Virginia. The flyer also urged people to scan a QR code to demand a congressional investigation. Mrs. Miller told the police and Secret Security camera footage appeared to confirm that at one point she noticed Ms. Nguyen walking to the front door of a neighboring home, court papers said. According to the affidavit, Mrs. Miller saw Ms. Nguyen make a gesture by pointing her index finger and middle fingers to her own eyes and then pointing directly at Mrs. Miller. Mrs. Miller interpreted this gesture to mean, "I'm watching you," and perceived it as a threatening act intended to intimidate or harass her, the affidavit said. Based on the timing, context, and manner of the gesture, the action is being treated as a potential act of intimidation in furtherance of the conduct under investigation. A state police agent, in seeking Ms. Nguyen's cell phone, told her that she was being investigated for a possible violation of a Virginia state law that makes it a misdemeanor to publish a person's name or photograph along with identifying information with the intent to coerce, intimidate, or harass another person, according to court documents. Mr. Haywood, in court papers, argued that Secret Service agents have gathered evidence showing Ms. Nguyen had not violated the law. She made crystal clear that to the extent that she had been active in protests against the Trump administration, she has never sought to intimidate, coerce, or harass anyone, but rather to express her strong disapproval of those in leadership who have directed a campaign of oppression against immigrants and other vulnerable members of our community, the filing said. Through this investigation, it is impossible to reach any conclusion other than that Ms. Nguyen poses no risk of harm to Stephen or Katie Miller, even if harm is as minor as coercion or harassment, Mr. Haywood wrote in the filing. According to the affidavit for the search warrant, the police in neighboring Fairfax County had acquired a text message Ms. Nguyen sent to a WhatsApp group in April. It asserted that Mr. Miller, the evil fascist behind family separations and deportation policies, had moved into Arlington. It is unclear how or why the Fairfax police had access to communications in that group chat. His wife sits there smugly swilling wine on their patio while her husband orders the arrest of more and more of our Muslim, Arab American, and Hispanic brothers and sisters, Ms. Nguyen wrote. My showing up for racial justice, SURJ, chapter in North Virginia, intends to make his life hell. We have set up a carefully vetted signal group. The language, the Virginia State Police officer wrote, clearly demonstrates an intent to threaten, intimidate, coerce, or harass Mr. Miller. In recent weeks, the legal fight broadened into a battle over jurisdiction, with the county prosecutor handling the case, accusing the state's attorney general of trying to usurp her authority. When the top prosecutor in Arlington, Parissa Degani Tafti, learned that federal agents had accompanied the local police to execute the warrant, she took the rare step of filing her own motion, arguing that additional limits should be placed on what parts of Ms. Nguyen's phone could be searched. The judge overseeing the matter then ordered the state police to pause its investigation of the phone while she considered the legal issues involved. Asked for comment, Ms. Dengadi Tafti said the matter remained pending, so I am limited in what I can say, but our office believes in the rule of law. She added, I believe in the First Amendment, and in order to maintain the public trust, we have to act with integrity, no matter who is a potential target or potential victim. And the rule of law encompasses both prosecuting fairly and protecting constitutional rights. After her office weighed in, the state attorney general tried to intervene, arguing that the judge's pause was unfair to the state police. The Virginia State Police cannot comply with their statutory obligations and simultaneously comply with the court's order, wrote Theophany K. Stamos, a deputy to Virginia's Attorney General Jason Meares, a Republican. The involvement of the state attorney general's office also thrust local politics into the dispute. Ms. Stamos has served as the top prosecutor in Arlington until she lost a Democratic primary to Ms. Degani Tafti in 2019. Ms. Degani Tafti fired back sharply, accusing the state attorney general's office of misstating the facts of the case. She urged the judge to disregard Mr. Meares's request, saying that concerns about individual privacy and potential infringement on First American rights should be balanced against the importance of a criminal investigation. The state attorney general, she argued, had no jurisdiction to weigh in on a misdemeanor investigation. Doing so now, she added, was part of what she described as a larger pattern by Mr. Meares's office of trying to push the bounds of the criminal justice system. Ms. Degani Tafti accused the Attorney General's office of trying to willfully ignore the constitutional rights of the citizens of the Commonwealth in hopes that they will receive some relief later. She added, "That is not justice." You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the November 5th issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Elizabeth Ortel. Thank you for listening.